Today's episode of Beyond the Mask is presented by the team at CRNA Financial Planning. Get a free consultation today to be guided through the complexities of investing and financial planning. Just visit crnafinancialplanning.com. Beyond the Mask is also sponsored by crnaeducation.com. CRNAs, you can get the CE credits you need by just going to crnaeducation.com. They have over 100 AANA prior approved credits, all four core CPC modules, and even over 40 pharmacology credits. No subscriptions, it's all online and mobile friendly. Just go to crnaeducation.com. And don't forget, listening to our podcast can earn you Class B credits. For more information on how you can submit them, check out our CE credit tab on our website, beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Welcome to the Beyond the Mask podcast. This is the Anesthesia Alchemy Edition, Terry and Gary Unplugged. Join hosts Gary Bridges and Terry Wicks as they deep dive into today's most important clinical conversations in a unique but educational way, in a humorous balance that only they can achieve. Let today's journey begin. Here are Terry and Gary with your next installment of Anesthesia Alchemy.
3, 2, 1.
Well, hello, faithful listeners. Here we are. Welcome back to another episode of Anesthesia Alchemy, Terry and Gary Unplugged. And as always, I'm Terry.
And I'm Gary. Today, folks, we're diving into the topic that's buzzing around everywhere. Marijuana!
What's that? What is that buzz? What's that smell?
It's expanding everywhere from county line to county line.
Giving a whole new meaning to smoke-filled rooms, right? Anyway, so this ever-controversial yet fascinating subject is one I think we need to take a listen to, also known as cannabis. Marijuana has a rich history of use both for medicinal and recreational purposes across many cultures, many countries, and in the United States, many state lines.
That's right, Terry. But, you know, what's really caught our attention lately is the surge in its popularity over the last few years, you know, especially with the increasing legalization across states, as you mentioned, and, you know, even throughout the world. I mean, you look up to Canada and it's coast to coast. You can get pot as liberally as you want.
from the capital Washington, D.C. to the West Coast, Washington, and places in between. As I say, when we were out in Seattle, one night I was walking to dinner, and I think I got a contact buzz 3 times in a mile. Anyway, so the stuff's in the air. But, you know,
was that the night you had 3 steaks?
It was. This came over me. I was so hungry. But you know what's really intriguing and really of a concern for us, the anesthesia community, too, is the rise of vaping. Not only just tobacco, but of course, especially talking about the anesthetic implications of cannabis, vaping in our community and surgical community as well.
Indeed, Terry. You know, and vaping has actually been advertised and touted as a safer alternative to traditional smoking, quickly becoming the go-to method for many marijuana users, including in our adolescent population. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about vaping and its issues in itself of how components of marijuana are actually carried in the vaping substances, but certainly a great topic and one that we need to dive in a little bit deeper to because it does and will have long-lasting effects, I think, in our patient populations.
Yeah, and we know from previous publications that have done systematic reviews of the implications of vaping, especially on the adolescent young and the consequences of inhaling heated vitamin E oils are very harmful and cause a lot of problems. But there's a lot of real risk involved in inhaling heated vapors, whether it's tobacco or cannabis.
Yeah, you know, recent studies, I think there was one in January edition of Anesthesia and Analgesia, looking at some of like the legal and regulatory aspects of medical cannabis in United States, especially, and I think that was led by Hong Greenwood or Greenwood Hong. Some of these studies raised concerns about things, as you mentioned, the effects of vaping on our respiratory health, and especially with regards to temperature-induced toxins, as you've mentioned, you know, the heated component of that also not to be overlooked is the volatile organic compounds that actually are entering our lung tissue when we use these products.
Yeah, it's just like with tobacco. I mean, when you burn tobacco, it liberates, you know, heavy metals and carcinogens, mm-hmm. and other sorts of pollutants, which obviously are incidental to the target combustible, which is nicotine. So mm-hmm. yeah, it's not surprising that there's a lot of unwanted compounds that wind up in the vape of marijuana smoke as well. But you know, this is really where it hits close to home. You know, Gary, in the surgical room, you know, if you hear me right, there are individuals who vape marijuana and they find themselves facing surgery, and there are some important considerations that need to be addressed by us as anesthesia providers. But one study showed that as many as 17 to 34% of patients who presented for outpatient surgery had a recent history of using cannabis or marijuana. So it's out there, and it's going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
Absolutely, Terry. You know, and really assessing those levels of intoxication for evaluating pulmonary function, kind of taking that a little bit further as far as some of the literature, those oils or emollients that get heated, actually when they go and land on the lung tissue, actually burn the lung tissue, and they do create forms of, I'll add, extreme forms of adult respiratory distress syndrome. And so, you know, there have been cases about a decade ago of adolescents dying from vaping, whether you have marijuana or not in the vapes, but not a good option, certainly historically. You know, there's a whole list of things that healthcare providers need to tick off before, you know, going through that evaluation and taking somebody back to put them to sleep and just before they go under the knife.
There is a possibility too, in folks that have a history of heavy marijuana use, that they could experience withdrawal symptoms. And even though low levels of stimulating cannabinoid receptors type 1, and we'll get into that a little bit, have been known to reduce anxiety. And there's actually some indications, limited indications for anxiety reduction. But in folks that are heavy users, there can be some pretty profound anxiety, particularly when patients stop vaping marijuana pre-surgery. There can be a little bit of abstinence symptoms, if you will.
You know, I have
to say abstinence makes the heart grow fonder.
Grow fonder, yeah, as long as we're not doing heart surgery. It does remind me, you know, I laugh a little bit because I remember caring for a patient, 20 years ago, at LBJ in Houston, Texas. And I remember out doing the pre-op and, you know, this old frail lady, we were doing some head and neck procedure, and it was fairly uncomfortable. It was for goiter. Anyway, I'm pre-opping her. She had to be in her mid to late 80s. And, you know, I said, well, you know, some painful the condition you've got. You know, how do you get by with it? She goes, I have pain medication. And I said, oh, yeah, okay, well, what are you using? Is it OxyContin? And she goes, no, come here for a minute. So she has me lean over the rail and she says, I smoke a lot of pot. She says, that gets me through. I was like, all right, well, whatever works, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is crucial for clinicians to really understand and offer proper preoperative counseling and support services to help these patients through transitions, whether they're trying to slow down or should they be slowing down. And, you know, being a little knowledgeable in this area to be able to properly inform our patients before going back for surgery, I think is critical.
Yeah, and I think as providers, we have to present ourselves as being non-judgmental and not to discourage patients from disclosing their use of cannabis products or smoking marijuana, because there are important anesthesia implications that we'll talk about those in a few minutes, but we have to take the posture that these are things that people do, and we just have to be aware of them. So, but anyway, today's episode is all about shedding light on these pre-surgical and anesthetic considerations for individuals who vape or use marijuana or even cannabinoid products on a daily or frequent basis.
Yeah, and by understanding these risks, you know, healthcare providers, they do, anesthesia providers specifically, because it seems to always fall on us. But it does help ensure not only a safer surgery, certainly a safer anesthetic, given the drugs that we use, and being knowledgeable of how this works and how we use our adjuncts as well as our main anesthetic agents. But also, you know, the ultimate goal or objective is really achieving better postoperative outcomes. And so what does that look like in the postoperative phase?
And so, you know, we have to, you know, be mindful of the, you know, systemic implications of using, particularly inhaled marijuana. There's can provoke some pesky comorbidities and systemic perturbations. Ooh, I like that word. And that could complicate matters even further. So let's, it's all about getting thorough and having an understanding of the patient's physiology and ensuring a smooth journey from that preoperative gurney right into the PACU.
You know, I think folks, you know, we've covered this kind of component as sort of an interlude to it, but we're going to delve a little bit deeper into this topic that's pretty important. And, you know, as we've mentioned, if you go back to the Anesthesia and Analgesia January edition of 2024, I mean, there's, what, 4 or 5 articles right out of the gate that I think are probably some good ones. And I don't know if we've put it in the reference list here. I will tell you that we've compiled a pretty comprehensive reference list because we know this is an emerging topic and people are going to see this a lot more. And so we want to make sure that we put those references in your hands, whether you're a patient, whether you're a CRNA, or whether you're the public with just some interest. Could be the media that might have an interest. So we've been intentionally exhaustive on the literature as far as resources for this episode.
And given the prevalence of cannabis use and marijuana use in the United States from coast to coast, and the varying degrees of legality and the inherent conflict between federal law and state law and all of those things. So we know people out there are going to be using these products and you're going to encounter them. So let's dig into what some of the nitty gritty of what happens inside the body when you start to consume cannabis and cannabis products.
That's right, Terry. Let's buckle up, listeners, because we're about to take you on that ride through pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics of cannabis. I can't wait.
You're driving too fast. Slow down a little bit. Slow down.
Jeez, that's just a perception going, that we're going fast.
Oh, that's right. We're not going any. We're not going any faster than 15 miles an
hour.
That's
right. We're still in first gear.
That's right. We haven't left the parking lot. All right. Let's start with pharmacokinetics, and that's no simple thing. Cannabis is a complex plant that has a multitude of chemical components in the cannabis products and in the smoke. It's packed with over 100 different compounds, including cannabinoids like tetrahydrocannabinol and CBD products, as well as terpenes and flavonoids and probably some stuff that we don't even know about yet.
Yeah, when you smoke cannabis, THC gets absorbed lickety-split through those lungs, hits peak levels in just about a minute or few, but it's quick. But if you're munching on those edibles there, I know which some people are doing. Well, it's a whole different story. You know, the effects take their sweet time of kicking in, if you know what I mean. You know, they peak after about several hours because the THC needs to be metabolized by the liver. So that takes a little bit more time before it certainly. As we all know, if you aerosolize an agent, faster uptake and distribution.
One thing our patients need to be aware of and be a little bit cautious about with those edibles, because it doesn't kick in right away. There's always a temptation to eat that second brownie.
And then
you're on the roller coaster.
That's
ride.
Right. You've now taken the second portion of the anesthetic, and we're good.
One and one is probably at least three. So let's talk about distribution, because this is part of the pharmacokinetic story. And tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC, and the CBDs as well, they love fat, folks. They're very lipid soluble. Mm-hmm. They're highly lipophilic, and it's all about fat life, which, as we get older, becomes more a part of our consciousness. But this leads to a pretty high volume of distribution throughout the body, and a big volume of distribution is a long elimination halftime. We know that too. So plus, it's a big time lover of protein binding and sticks to proteins in the blood. And so as a result of being bound to proteins, it's not filtered very well by the kidneys, and this stuff tends to hang around a while.
As we've seen in our test subjects out on the street.
I've met people is what I'm saying.
That's right. Yeah. Now, you know, when it comes to metabolism, the liver is where the magic happens. Everybody remembers, you know, those enzymes in the liver called the cytochrome P450 system. That's what does break down the THC into various metabolites, which are then made ready for excretion through urine and feces. And so anything that affects that cytochrome P450 system, we got to remember, either upregulates or downregulates, will then have a secondary effect on any of the signs and symptoms or pharmacodynamics of THC.
Yeah, and its effect on those cytochrome P450 enzymes is important too, because it will inhibit some of those members of that family and result in other drugs that the patient might be taking having a more pronounced effect because of increased bioavailability due to decreased metabolism. But so that's maybe a topic for a whole nother day. But the bottom line is, because of this protein binding and the lipid solubility volume distribution, there's no quick exit for the old THC. Nope, its elimination half-life can vary really wildly, and it can be in your system for days and days and days. And you know, then you got that, you know, that drug screen coming up for that job interview, and what do you know? It's been a week, but doggone, there's still some of that hanging around in your fat.
Yeah, I remember, back in the late 90s, early 2000, I was working with an anesthesiologist that was leaving the state of Texas to move to greener pastures, apparently, in Arizona. And I remember one day in the OR, he was dancing around. I said, "What is wrong with you?" He says, "Well, I just applied for my license in Arizona, and there's mandatory testing." I said, "So that should be just a slam dunk." He goes, "Nope." I said, "Well, why? What's wrong?" Well, this was it, the lingering THC. But, you know, let's not leave CBD out of the equation. You know, while it might not get you high like THC, it's still got its own pharmacokinetic dance, if you will. It does reach peak concentrations in about 4 hours after ingestion. And again, it undergoes metabolism in the liver, so cytochrome P450, and it takes its sweet time, as we've mentioned earlier, and before it does bid adieu at its terminal half-life. So
it's going to be your buddy for a while. So now we've covered, just broadly, we've talked about pharmacokinetics, and I'm going to turn our attention to a little bit to pharmacodynamics, because this is really some interesting stuff that we're going to bring up here. So let's imagine this. You're inhaling those aerosolized particles of cannabis, and they're off on a mission inside your body. Woo, and they go everywhere, and they have lots of things to do.
Yeah, those cannabinoid-like substances like THC, CBD are on the quest to interact with our, you know, endocannabinoid receptors throughout our body, specifically CB1 and CB2. You know, CB1 receptors are like the VIPs, if you will, mainly chilling in the brain, but it's also scattered throughout the body. While the CB2 receptors, they hang out in our immune cells in the gut, where that really brings in some interesting conversations with respect to what they do affect and surgical interventions.
Hey, CRNAs, it's time to simplify your continuing education. Welcome to CRNAEducation.com, your trusted provider for CPC core modules and a plethora of Class A CE credits. You can explore 43 detailed articles covering various anesthesia topics, all from your favorite device, anytime, anywhere. And with over 40 pharmacology CE credits, meet your state board requirements effortlessly. Whether you need a few credits or everything to recertify, we have what you need. Just complete your credits online without any subscriptions or recurring charges. You can trust in our 100% CRNA-owned platform, established in 2011, ensuring you receive the best in customer service and educational content. Ready to learn? Go to CRNAEducation.com. Making continuing education easy and accessible. And don't forget that support is always a quick email or a text or phone call away. To sign up and learn more, just go to crnaeducation.com.
Well, you know, my understanding is, not personally, of course, but from people I've talked to, is that, you know, THC is the life of the party, and it specifically acts as a partial agonist on the CB1 receptors. CBDs, on the other hand, are not agonists on CB1 receptors. They exert their effects on the CB2 receptor in sort of an allosteric, if you will, way. But they do enhance the THC's effects through CB1 receptor-dependent mechanism.
Yeah, you know, again, that article in Anesthesia and Analgesia, the basic science of cannabinoids, and that one was written by, I think, Sedaris, and they go into that quite eloquently, if you will, talking about all of the... you know, the lock and key mechanisms and the allosteric changes of the receptor sites that enhance or abate their effects on these receptors. So again, another really interesting read. You know, like there's some stuff out there that people are taking, like K2 Spice, right, which has a full agonist effect. You know, some of the partial agonists, you know, as Terry has mentioned, the THC. And then you got neutral agonists, and those tend to decrease inflammation. That tends to be the CBD oil. So, you know, even in pets, I get people that tell me, oh, if your dog's having joint pain and stuff, try CBD oil. It works like a charm. Then there's the inverse agonists, and, you know, those are typically the synthetic cannabinoids that are produced by drug companies. So... you know, let's not forget also about nicotine, folks. It's not just about cannabis and those vaping clouds. Nicotine's in that mix too, right? It tinker around with our nicotinic acetylcholine receptors, and it does potentially stir up some trouble with some interactions and effects in addition to, you know, the agents, obviously, that we're administering.
You know, so as Gary mentioned, folks, this is just a crash course in the inner workings of cannabis in our bodies, and there are literally a whole catalog of effects on the GI tract and the central nervous system and on immunity and inflammation that are beyond the scope of just this conversation that we're having today. But it does underscore the complexity of the endocannabinoid system. A substance that we could take in can affect all of those systems. So, you know, we've covered the science behind how cannabinoids interact with our bodies a little bit, but let's zoom in on some of the physiologic effects that it can have that are important to us.
There's a whole slew of them, and I think that goes into, Terry, the article that you had brought up about cannabinoids and cannabis in the perioperative period, and I think that was published by Bradley, again, in the January issue of Anesthesia and Analgesia, and they have a beautiful chart, but I'm not going to get into all of the nuances of that, but the first up one that we'll talk about is pain relief. Cannabis has been a go-to for folks dealing with chronic pain, and for good reason. THC and other cannabinoids do cozy up to our cannabinoid system, and they work their magic by activating CB1 receptors, whether it's allosterically or partially agonistic. And they do work in the brain and the spinal cord quite well, dialing down those little pesky inflammatory mediators. And as we know, inflammation is one of the major contributors to pain propagation, as well as the pain pathways. And so it does blunt those in a really good way.
Yeah, and it almost acts like, you know, slamming the brakes on pain transmission at the synaptic level, which is pretty fascinating. The postsynaptic membrane liberates substances related to cannabinoids that actually diminish calcium entry presynaptically and reduce transmission. So that's pretty fascinating stuff. Yeah. And, you know, to me personally, you know, I've been astounded at how important calcium really is, and not just, you know, neuromuscular transmission, but nociception. And it's a whole new area that's opening up. You know, but all of this talk of cannabinoids has made me hungry, Gary. Oh, yeah, that's right. We're going to talk about munchies. That's right. You know, one of the things about THC that we know is that it actually is noted for its ability to stimulate appetite and makes it useful for folks that have historically used it to increase oral intake when they've been on chemotherapy. But it does flip the switch on our CB1 receptors, cranks up the release of ghrelin, the hunger hormone. You know, and if you've been giving this stuff to your dog and you see him rummaging through the refrigerator at night, you'll know why. Maybe more concerning, though, is it does interfere with the function of leptin, which is that satiety hormone that is released when our stomachs get full. So it promotes hunger, it decreases satiety. So it's no wonder you've got your head in the freezer looking. And who ate that gallon of butter pecan ice cream? Yeah, so that's what happens after a good smoke, right?
Absolutely. Now, let's talk a little bit about epilepsy. CBD steps into the spotlight here. You know, it shows off its impressive resume of neuroprotective and anticonvulsant properties, does a very good job of controlling or reducing episodes of epilepsy. And in fact, it has been so effective that the FDA actually gave the nod to, I believe it's called Epidiolex, pretty close to epilepsy, so easy to remember.
Yeah.
But it is used for treating rare epilepsy disorders in patients as young as 2 years old. So we know that when drugs come to market, they're typically not introduced in the pediatric population. So this gives hope to, you know, those that do have, is it intractable epilepsy that are so bad that CBD, and I've seen actually 60-minute episodes on this that, and this was pre-FDA approval, that it worked so well that it was difficult to get some of these compounds, you know, a while ago, but it was typically the only thing that worked in their kids that had epilepsy, so...
Yeah, and I think, like you said, I think the studies and the clinical results are pretty compelling. But you know what? It's not all rainbows, sunshine, and burritos, buddy. That effect on THC can really cross wires in your brain and cause you to crash pretty hard. And with high doses, can provoke pretty severe anxiety, yeah, psychotic symptoms, and memory impairment. And let's not forget that at its root, tetrahydrocannabinol is a hallucinogenic drug, and in low doses seems to have pretty pleasant effects, and high doses can be a little bit problematic. Now, on the other hand, CBD is like a calming voice of reason, and we all need that these days.
Oh, yes.
And it has that soothing anxiolytic and antipsychotic effects, and you know, it just makes everything so much more pleasant.
I just think of the song of Purple Haze.
Exactly.
Well, you know, and speaking of memory impairment, Terry, you know, let's not overlook the short-term effects of cannabis use. THC is notorious for throwing a wrench into our working memory and attention, messing with the prefrontal cortex of our brains, you know, and that's, as you all remember, folks, is the brain center for these cognitive tasks, if you will.
Executive function and problem solving.
Who needs that?
Who needs that? Well, you know, it's not all about your brain, Gary. You know, we have to think about our hearts. Take it to heart. So these compounds, they can have a pretty significant effect on cardiovascular performance and actually maybe even increase risk of myocardial ischemia, because cannabis can increase your heart rate, your blood pressure. And of course, that's, you know, heart rate was it left end diastolic?
Oh, yeah.
And diastolic wall volume. Pressure. Yeah,
right.
Baby. Now we're talking about MVO2 is going to skyrocket. And, you know, thanks to those CB1 receptors doing their thing right there at the heart of the matter, as Don Henley would say, your heart and blood vessels. Now, just to highlight some of these concerns for patients coming to the OR, the differences in the implications in someone who is acutely intoxicated or someone who might be a chronic user. So, for example, in the acute phase of intoxication, you're going to see increases in heart rate and blood pressure and cardiac output, and then eventually maybe some slowing of the heart rate and lowering of blood pressure. But in high doses, you're going to see a very profound parasympathetic response, and that may result in some big decreases in heart rate and blood pressure, some dysrhythmias, and there is a track record of increased risk of an MI and acute intoxication. Now, in chronic use, over time, there is a baseline increase in heart rate and cardiac output. And then eventually, with higher doses, you're going to get decreased heart rate and blood pressure. So there is a difference between acute and chronic intoxication. Now, when we turn our attention out into the periphery and the blood vessels, in acute intoxication, there's increased cerebral blood flow with endothelial vasodilation, and then reduced cerebral blood flow with hypoxia and hypercapnia superimposed on all of the cardiac effects. And in the long term, there is an increased risk of cerebral vascular accidents and TIAs. So, you know, it's even though you're hungry, there's no free lunch.
Oh, no, not at all. You know, and Terry, let's not forget about the lungs again. You know, I know we've harped on a little bit. Inhaling cannabis smoke might not even secondary is not as this innocent as it may have seemed in the past. You know, it does lead to respiratory issues like bronchitis, chronic coughs, not to mention impaired lung function. That's why it's crucial for patients really to consider alternative methods of administration before surgery. And I would argue against vaping versus, if you're going to do it, probably the ingestion, whether it's through a smoke or whether it's through chewables. But, you know, I mean, the acute phase, you're going to see things like bronchodilation, but you will have some airway hyperreactivity. And there's been notation of pharyngeal edema when, and that's probably all of the bronchodilation, the coughing and the bucking and whatnot. And so you can also get uvular edema in the acute phase because your body is responding to these chemicals and having an immune response. Now, chronic use, you're obviously going to start to see some chronic bronchitis, and you will have some increase in lung volume with chronic use, but, you know, that's questionable depending on whether you're vaping or not. So, interesting stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's just never a good idea to inhale anything except the good old mountain air.
That's right.
You don't want to put bad stuff in your lungs. You really don't. And so, you know, there you have it, listeners. And it's a roller coaster of physiologic effects that are brought to you by cannabis, and particularly tetrahydrocannabinol and CBDs. So let's take a little bit deeper dive into some of the clinical considerations for patients who vape marijuana in the preoperative period.
Today's show is brought to you by the folks at CRNA Financial Planning, an independent consulting firm that offers financial planning services exclusively to CRNAs and their families. From planning for a child's future college expenses to building a predictable income stream in retirement, the firm is committed to offering you comprehensive financial services customized to fit your unique needs and objectives. If you have questions about your financial future, get them answered. Call the team at 855-304-3748. That's 855-304-3748. Or go online to crnafinancialplanning.com.
Yeah, Terry, you know, vaping has obviously been some of the go-to methods for many marijuana users, especially among adolescents, as we've mentioned earlier. But, you know, let's look at and see, what does this mean for those that use and when they're heading into surgery?
So let's just break down vaping itself. It's all about heating up substances like nicotine and cannabis to release an aerosolized mixture, which is then inhaled. And this method sidesteps the harmful byproducts of combustion found in smoke, minimizing respiratory issues like increased bronchial reactivity and lung inflammation. That's still not good for you.
Yeah, that's right, Terry. You know, and while vaping and smoking cannabis can deliver similar levels of THC, studies do suggest vaping does pack perhaps a stronger punch due to the higher THC concentrations in the blood itself.
Yeah, and I think particularly with vaping, because there is usually an oil-based vehicle that's used, you do have a more rapid onset and movement of those THC chemicals across those physiologic membranes, which tend to be resistant to water-soluble elements. And so you have a more rapid onset compared to other methods, and thanks to rapid absorption in the lungs. But here's the kicker. This means patients might experience decreased reaction time and impaired judgment.
Oh, come on.
And you see, no, I'm serious. And you see signs on the highway. I've seen this myself in Illinois, that driving buzzed is driving impaired. Now, I realize that's a little judgmental, coming to surgery, that could have some good and important implications.
Yeah, folks, it doesn't speed up the surgery, just in case you're wondering.
Just seems like it.
It seems like, right, yeah. But, you know, clinicians do need to be on their A game when they're assessing these patients who vape marijuana before surgery. You know, for potential, obviously for potential drug interactions, because as we've already alluded to some of them with pain receptors, you know, nicotinic receptors, etc. And that's going to have some impact with patients' recent vaping history. Every little detail in our preoperative anesthesia assessment does really matter in these circumstances.
Yeah, let's not gloss over the lingering effects of cannabis. Even if a patient hasn't vaped recently, cannabis can still influence pain perception, coordination, cognition, alertness, executive function, all that stuff that's supposed to be going on in the frontal cortex.
Yeah,
it's a whole package deal, buddy.
You know, with the legal landscape surrounding cannabis constantly evolving, clinicians do need to stay informed about the laws in their specific state where they're working with patients who do vape marijuana.
You know, if you're heading into surgery and you've been vaping, you know, don't keep it under wraps. You should disclose that to your anesthesia provider, you know, to be open about your cannabis use, you know, and together you and the anesthesia provider can work together to ensure a safe and successful surgical experience for you. Now that we've covered the preoperative considerations, let's shift our focus just to what happens during surgery, that intraoperative anesthesia considerations, which is where we do our work and where we have our most acute concerns.
Yeah, right, Terry. You know, cannabis doesn't just sit back and relax once the surgery starts, folks. It can throw a curveball into the mix when it comes to, you know, drug interactions with anesthetic agents, analgesics, and not to mention some of the systemic effects that we see, and we've alluded to that in some of the physiology, but there is some anesthetic implications, as Terry has noted.
Yeah, exactly right, Gary. And cannabis and cannabinoids like to mingle with enzymes like our old friends, the CYP34A and CYP2C9, all the whole cytochrome P450 families out there dancing around wondering what's happening. And it's going to slow down the metabolism of other medications. And so let's not forget about their dance with the GABAergic system, which plays a crucial role in the activity with many anesthetic agents. And that's probably one of the foundational ways that, you know, drugs like propofol and, you know, back in the bad old days, thiopental and etomidate,
all stuff
work on GABA receptors. And so when we start fooling around with them, things can change.
Absolutely right, Terry. And I look at cytochrome P450, 3A4, 2C9, if I remember correctly. Isn't that what codeine is? A two-pathway metabolism. And so here's what's interesting. Cannabis and cannabinoid-like drugs go through these pathways like codeine. And sometimes you can have upregulation or downregulation of one of those two enzymes, and it will take a preferential pathway. And we know what pediatrics with codeine, that I believe it's the 3A4 pathway. If you upregulate it or you downregulate 2C9, it preferentially converts and metabolizes through the 3A4 pathway in the liver. What happens? Codeine gets transferred into morphine. And so we were seeing a lot of respiratory arrest in the pediatric population because we didn't know about the pharmacogenomics. And so this adds one more layer of complexity into what we do every day in the operating room when we're administering, you know, anesthetics and not paying attention to some of this stuff and the pharmacogenomics of it. And so, you know, in fact, there was a study that found patients consuming cannabis needed actual higher doses of propofol for certain procedures. So anesthesia providers need to be vigilant about screening patients for cannabis use before surgery, without question.
Yeah, yeah. And pain management with cannabis can really be a double-edged sword. You know, and while popularly it's been hailed for its analgesic properties, prolonged use can lead to tolerance withdrawal. And there are some studies that suggest that postoperatively, chronic THC users have increased pain postoperatively. And, you know, another implication is that there is some gender dimorphism such that the effects can be more pronounced in men than women, depending on the specific characteristic they're working about. So it's a really complicated picture.
Yeah, yeah. So let's tackle postoperative nausea and vomiting, my favorite. You know, when cannabinoids were initially explored as effective antiemetics, you know, more recent studies have actually linked prolonged cannabis use with hyperemesis. So, you know, the best prevention, abstinence before surgery, certainly for chronic users, as we start to see. So there is a clear distinction between acute use versus chronic use. And so those chronic users, they're going to be retching their guts out in the PACU, and there's nothing we can do about it.
Yeah, that cannabis hyperemesis syndrome is really hard to treat, as you mentioned. It's really difficult. And then there's, and again, what crops up is this cannabis withdrawal syndrome. You know, patients that use cannabis chronically and then stop or reduce their use, you can get with, you know, abstinence syndromes, experience things like irritability, insomnia, decreased appetite. They might have to use cannabis again to get their appetite back. But anyway, just kidding. Now, so there aren't really any approved drugs for treating cannabis withdrawal symptoms in the perioperative period. But maybe medications like Zolpidem or mirtazapine have been shown to alleviate some of those symptoms. Anyway, listeners, let's wrap up today's episode with some insights into recent clinical findings regarding cannabis use in the perioperative setting.
Yeah. So, you know, with the legalization of marijuana in many states now, you know, and its growing interest in its medical applications, we're seeing more and more cannabis users coming in for elective surgery. And, you know, I just can't help think about the resonance of state of Colorado, for example. And, you know, my wife
got back
from British Columbia in Vancouver, and she says, Papi, you would not believe the number of cannabis stores that are lined up on the streets.
Gosh, yeah.
They're everywhere. Yeah.
Well, and even driving across Illinois, where that's been a relatively recent legalization, I think within the last 2 years, there's signs along Interstate 80.
Oh, my God.
Goodness gracious. And then there's signs in Indiana goes, it's not legal here, folks. Anyway. So, you know, interestingly enough, there is a recent study that came out of an academic center in Boston that found that every seventh patient presenting for elective surgery was a cannabis user. Now, and I don't think Massachusetts, is that a legal state?
It's legal now. Yeah.
Well, it must be. Well, so it's up to every seventh patient that may, and you know what? I'm guessing the numbers are probably higher than that.
Yeah.
So it's pretty important for us as anesthesia providers to have really good guidelines for safe anesthetic management of these patients.
Absolutely, Terry. You know, one of the pioneering sets of guidelines that came from the Perioperative Pain and Addiction Interdisciplinary Network, you know, they outlined a number of recommendations, which are in our reference list, by the way, for defining significant cannabis consumption and advised weaning off cannabis for more than 7 days before surgery for heavy users. Again, let me repeat that. Significant cannabis consumption, the advisement is wean off these patients off of cannabis more than 7 days before surgery. This is particularly in the heavy chronic users. And we've mentioned a number of side effects, not only intraoperatively the physiologic side effects, but the retching of postoperative nausea and vomiting that we're not going to be able to treat with any other of the drugs. So problematic.
Yeah. So, yeah, and it's really, we can't forget about the importance of doing a thorough preoperative assessment and intraoperative monitoring. And, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about the importance of preoperative assessment in avoiding litigation and how not knowing things about your patient can get you and the patient in trouble. So the anesthesia patient safety guidelines emphasize a thorough preoperative assessment, and they stress the need for possibly additional PONV prophylaxis and vigilant monitoring for those signs of hemodynamic instability that we described early, and airway irritability and everything that goes along with those things. It's important to keep our ear to the ground.
Yeah, you know, in that same note, the American Society of Regional Anesthesia also stepped up with detailed guidelines for evaluating patients with chronic cannabis use. Again, The chronic users tend to be that special subpopulation that we need to be concerned with, particularly in the pregnant patients. Heaven forbid a pregnant mom is smoking marijuana, but it happens. And, you know, the guidelines do highlight the importance of screening for cannabis use. So those of you that are doing OB and slipping those epidurals in and doing C-sections, you want to make sure that you're screening for this stuff and considering postponing surgery. Not sure how you do that when the little critter's coming out. But, yeah. You know, if patients do show up with signs of intoxication from cannabis use, there's some serious considerations that need to be accounted for in that evaluation.
Yeah, and I could tell you just from my own experience in doing OB anesthesia that there are times when you ask patients about drug use, they're coming in labor. When did you last use? And they'll say, well, I fired up out in the parking lot.
That's right.
I came in.
You got
and
that right.
That's real. That's real. And I think we're going to see more and more of that. So, folks, whether you're a healthcare provider or you're a patient, it's essential to stay informed, follow the guidelines to ensure safe and effective perioperative care for cannabis users. All right, listeners, let's sum up everything we've discussed today regarding the complex interplay between marijuana, vaping, anesthesia, CBDs, and the like. So, Gary, take her away.
Yeah, you know, marijuana and vaping, as we know, have become household names with millions of users turning to them for a range of reasons, from recreational enjoyment all the way through medical relief. You know, we're not here to knock it either way. We're just here that there is some risk. We want to point that out to our clinicians. And those of you that are non-clinicians just listening, we want to make sure that you do understand that there is consequences for using these, more specifically in the perioperative phase. And, you know, this is a non-judgmental podcast, if you will. And so our goal is to keep everybody safe and make sure that anesthesia providers are doing the right thing.
And draw a firm line under the fact that these substances can really significantly impact the patient's response to anesthesia, and they can alter their postoperative pain management and requirements and increase the risk of complications, both cardiovascular and neurologic and pain. And it's a whole catalog of problems.
Yeah, let's not forget about vaping, which can wreak havoc on the respiratory system, hinder the body's ability for recovery after surgery. You know, and when I state that, I can't help have that image in my head when I'm sitting at the stoplight on my way home from work, and I see the big cloud in the car, and when they roll down the window, it's like some hurricane coming out of the inside of the car. It's just, what happened there?
Yeah. They're either smoking pot or the upholstery's on fire. I'm not sure which it is. Yeah, so, you know, we've got a duty as anesthesia providers is being patient advocates to do a little patient education. That's absolutely crucial. You know, we're talking about this landscape of opioid or cannabis use and marijuana use. So we have to arm our patients with knowledge, inform them, tell them what's going on, and hopefully we can minimize the potential adverse effects associated with combining marijuana products and anesthesia implications. And, you know, and one of the things that we've sort of glossed over, but I think is important to mention too, is that there's not an infrequent association with cannabis intoxication and co-administration of other psychomimetic drugs stimulants and alcohol and the whole nine yards.
It's a domino effect, if you will. And throughout the entire surgical process, continuous monitoring from our perspective as anesthesia providers is obviously key and crucial to what we do. So we need to really be vigilant in detecting and addressing not only the sobriety or lack thereof, if you will, but also the adverse reactions, and promptly intervening, because we need to be knowledgeable on this stuff and recognize quickly when these side effects or adverse reactions are starting to ensue.
Yep. So to all the anesthesia providers out there and surgeons and even perioperative clinicians, remember these key points. Consider the pharmacodynamics of marijuana use and vaping, you know, and being vigilant about conducting that focused pre-surgical and pre-anesthetic evaluation. And remember, you know, we have a duty to adhere to standard guidelines for patient care to promote patient safety and keep our patients and ourselves out of trouble.
Absolutely, Terry. You know, and if everybody, by taking these essential steps, we could ensure safe and effective anesthetic experiences for our patients who have either vaped or smoked marijuana before surgery, all we want is the best possible outcome for that individual and make sure that we intervene appropriately.
Absolutely. And so that's it for today's episode, folks. Thank you for staying with us and listening. Stay informed, stay vigilant, and keep striving for excellence in patient care.
And as always, keep tuning in to Anesthesia Alchemy, Terry and Gary Unplugged, for more insightful discussions on the most current topic on all things in anesthesia. So we do encourage you, if you like this podcast, please visit the website, give us a thumbs up or thumbs down if you think there's some opportunity for growth. Certainly leave us some comments. We would love to hear from you. You know, we want to keep bringing you some of the most current literature and topics that are out there in the clinical world. And those of you that are non-clinicians, we hope you're learning through some of our serious discussions as well as making lighthearted of some of the topics that we do discuss. Because, you know, getting through this with a laugh and a smile and making sure that everybody's safe and we do really good anesthesia care and keeping abreast of all of the newest technologies is paramount.
All right. Until next time, ladies and gentlemen, happy trails to you. Tune in again and take care.
Hi, this is Jackie Rolls, president of the International Federation of Nurse Anesthetists and president and founder of Our Hearts, Your Hands, a global anesthesia support community that takes donations to allow nurse anesthetists in low and middle income countries to go to educational programs, buy equipment, or textbooks. Your donations are tax deductible, and we would appreciate your support.
Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and anywhere you like to listen to shows. Also, be sure to check out beyondthemaskpodcast.com. Each episode is posted there with a corresponding blog post, and we timestamp important parts of the episode to help you quickly get to the content you're looking for. Also, check out the special series section on the site. You can follow along and catch up on the CRNA History Series, episodes specifically about political conversations in the industry, or try the CRNA Personal Finance Series. It's all on beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And if you have a question for the show or want to be a guest or even suggest a particular topic, fill out the contact form on the site or send an email directly to us at info@beyondthemaskpodcast.com. And lastly, let's take the conversation social. Check out our Beyond the Mask podcast Facebook page and Facebook group.